tell you you don't want it, but your years grow by. Everybody wants to, everybody needs it. Something that could haunt you. I might just debate it, even if it hurts to. It might seem too crazy. Sorry, I've been removed. Back then, I shouldn't go back then. I shouldn't go back then.
Listeners, this is DJ DeMorgans. I am with Philosophy, We Think. And tonight, we're going to do something that's never been done before on this show. We're going to do a solo episode. So it's just yours truly. For those of you that have listened to Philosophy, We Think before, you notice that there is one soul and moving force of the show missing. That is DJ Geist. He is tied up tonight, so I'm taking over. Originally, we were supposed to have on the University of Texas graduate student, Henry Curtis, but he got sick, and so now he's also tied up. So what originally started as a three-person episode is down to a one-person episode, and I think I've still got some good stuff prepared for y'all. So it may be a little bumpy, maybe a little awkward, but I'm gonna try out my first ever solo episode. We'll see how it goes. For those of you that don't know, we are a philosophy talk show every Friday, and this semester we've been picking out specific papers on ethics, reading through canonical texts such as Immanuel Kant's Groundwork for the Metaphysics of Morals, Aristotle's Nicomachean Ethics, and David Hume's Ethics. He has two works, The Treatise of Human Nature, as well as The Inquiry Concerning the Principles of Morals. And we did some episodes on both of those. We also covered Nicolas Malebranche, who is not a canonical figure in history of ethics, but he does present a very interesting impetus for David Hume's ethics, and we thought that he would be rather relevant. So, that being said, I'm not covering ethics tonight. We have also taken some time throughout the semester to focus on our thesis. Both DJ Geist and I are writing theses on different topics, but fun topics. So what I'm writing over is composition, mereology. It's questions of metaphysics in philosophy, which is just a study of what is, I guess. It's kind of hard to define very broad terms like metaphysics or what is ethics. Well, I don't know. But metaphysics, as the best you can, is a study of what is. And mereology, or compositionality, is the study of composition. Under what conditions does composition occur, right? So you may think like the pen or maybe the car that you're sitting in right now is a composite object. Sure. It's composed of tires and a wheel, a steering wheel, that is, an engine, maybe some blue paint, red paint, hopefully not red paint, I don't know. I hear red cars get pulled over more often. But the point being, you think of it as a composite object, but if you put your water bottle on top of the car, surely combining the water bottle and the car didn't make a new object. But combining the steering wheel and the tires and all of the parts of the car combined a new object. So what conditions merited or rendered a new object present? The car. That's a question of mereology. That's what we're trying to get at right here. So the paper that I've read for today is, and I read this for my thesis advisor. I'm going to be meeting with him and talking about it next week. So, Daniel, if you're listening to this and it's a terrible interpretation, I cannot wait to talk about it next week and be corrected. But I read Gideon Rosen and Sion Dorr, I believe is the pronunciation. I read the paper Composition as Fiction. And if you've listened to past episodes, you also heard us cover I Do Not Exist by Peter Unger, where he goes into this thing called a Sorites argument to prove the non-existence of selves, more so composite objects at a whole, at a general level. Unger's not trying to necessarily make comments on identity there, because there's a sort of immaterial, or possibly, I should say, a possibly immaterial aspect to personal identity or the self or whatever you want to call it. But this is a bit of a different footing. And I, quite honestly, I was a bit dissatisfied when I finished the paper. I thought it was going to be coming to a sort of stronger conclusion, like Unger comes to, in the sense that if it's the case that we believe in atoms, then we have to believe that no material objects exist. There's a certain nihilism, this sort of like mereological nihilism. And just to give you guys a quick rundown, the argument from Unger's article goes like so. Say I have a table, and it's composed of, pick a number, 43 billion atoms. And I remove one atom. Is it still a table? Well, certainly, right? I remove another atom. Is it still a table? Certainly. I remove another atom. Is it still a table? Certainly. You can see where this is going. At what point do I remove an atom and it becomes not a table? Is it 50%? Is it 100%? It's kind of hard to say. Unger says that we need I believe the term that he uses is a miracle of foreknowledge or a miracle of insight, something like that, in order to know exactly when we remove one particular atom. And I'm speaking of atoms in the philosophical context. For those science nerds out there, you may be saying, well, atoms aren't the most fundamental thing. It's gluons or quarks or whatever it is. But I'm talking about atoms in the philosophical sense, and meaning that it's the most fundamental thing. Whatever that most fundamental thing, it's that. So at what point does it not become a table anymore? Is it something else? And Unger concludes that you can't know. You can't actually know when it becomes something else. And so therefore, we should just conclude that believing in composites leads to a contradiction, because you could take it all the way down and you would still say it's a table. Take all 40, I forget if I said 42 or 43, but take all of those billion atoms out. And now you have a materialless table. There's a table still there that's material, but it's not. at the same time. And this leads to a contradiction. So therefore, you can do this with any material object. We can't believe in material composites. And I'm using object and composites interchangeably here. But this doesn't take away our belief in atoms, right? Or philosophical atoms. Is there an atom there? Yeah. Take it away. Is there an atom there? No. Easy. You can solve the Sorites problem pretty easy there. Now, today, we're talking about this compositionist fiction paper. And it sort of begins with a proposition. And I'm going to try and paint a picture for you guys as well as I can, because there's a picture painted on the paper. Imagine a rectangle that represents all of space. Everything contained inside that rectangle is all of the space that exists. Right? So, imagine three point particles, as we'll frame them. So again, philosophical atoms, we can say. Imagine three point particles in this rectangle. One's A, one's B, and one's C. Okay? So they're all labeled. And they're the only things that are material, if you will, in this space. Now, A and B are touching each other. They're sort of stuck together, as you will. So much so that if I were to apply force on one of them, they would sort of move together as a unit, or in a sense that they act in a sense that they wouldn't act otherwise if they were disconnected. So we can think of maybe a glowing or a sort of sound that they emit when they're linked together. So when A and B are put together, as they are in this specific instance, they're linked together, then they give off a sort of glow-in-the-dark look, let's say. But they wouldn't exhibit that unless they were together. Now, C is spatially completely separated. It's not even close. It's effectively independent from the two other particles. So the question becomes, for mereology, how many objects are there? How many objects are there in this rectangle of space that we have? Five? Okay, so we have a listener here who's saying five. Four. So four is the most natural answer, right? So you have A, you have B as simple point particles, and you have C. And then you have A plus B, this sort of new thing that is made that glows in the dark, right? So I think the most common sense conception that you can bring to this car example that I was giving at the beginning of the show is, well, it's a sort of function thing. When I put my water bottle on top of the car, of course it doesn't make a new object. It doesn't make a new function. But when you put together all of those wires and metal pieces and whatnot, it creates a thing that has a new function, right? And this is what we're seeing with A and B. It's emitting that light. So the common sense answer is four, right? Now, there's a lot of stuff that goes into this, right? Peter Van Inwagen is a very prominent name here. In his book, Material Beings, he comes along and he introduces these sort of highly restrictive theories, such as mereological nihilism. He's not a strict nihilist in that sense. He's what they call he believes in organicism, I believe, is the proper name for it.
All the we'll get into that later in our show's history, but our show's future, I suppose. But essentially, he believes there are no composite objects. There's only tables, like we were talking about earlier, tables arranged atom-wise. But he also believes that the body, the self, is a composite object because you have some sort of intimate connection with the self, right? Right, so his claim is if there was a table, and then I can imagine a different world where there was only atoms, and they were atoms arranged table-wise, making them not a composite object, it would seem to me as though they were the same. There would be no seeming difference. Same thing with people. But with myself specifically, I have some sort of intimate connection that I know there's parts of myself, right? More so than I know there's, I guess it wouldn't be parts. I know that I'm a composite. I know that I'm an object, a whole, as opposed to just atoms arranged body-wise. So it's a lot harder to make that claim. Anyways, that's this organicism view that Van Inwagen produces. But the point being is there's a lot of different ways to look at it. This original example where we have A and B and C, and you know, common sense says, well, there's only four objects. But there's another view out there. So we've covered organicism or nihilism, which would just say, or nihilism, whichever pronunciation you prefer. That is just the denial. There's only A, B, and C. A and B don't make a new thing. And you may say, well, what about this function argument? Well, we'll get to that after the break in a bit. The nihilist is often willing to accept that, but that's not the point right now. We're just trying to lay out the views. These two views, however, so the sort of moderate view, the common sense view, which says four, the nihilist view, which says three, are not philosophically the most popular. The most popular that you see is known as unrestricted composition, or I guess I shouldn't say classical mereology, which has unrestricted composition. And I'm at a loss for the name, the mereological. It's just called classical mereology, which would actually posit that there aren't four, there aren't three, there's seven. There's seven objects in this, seven composite objects in this spatial realm that we're talking about. And there's a lot of, for those of you that are, you know, philosophical connoisseurs, there's a lot of people who supported this view. David Lewis, Quine, W.V. Quine, that's what I was trying to think of, Nelson Goodman. And it's sort of started by Stanislaw Lesniewski in the 1920s. Now, it's committed to four main axioms, right? Four main principles of the theory. First is reflexivity, which is kind of interesting in a sense, right? So reflexivity says that everything is a part of itself. And that's kind of an interesting claim, right? So my right hand is a part of my right hand. Is it? Or is it the whole? Is it a part? Because it seems as though maybe the parthood is a bit different. It is maybe not an inferiority, but a smaller part, right? You may take like you seem, common sense wants to say that you need something else to be a part, right? You don't just need one part to a whole. If it's that part, it is a whole, and it's not a part. Let me clarify this with an example. So let's imagine there's this guy named Fred, and Fred's a part of a conga line, right? So he's in this conga line, right? So he would be a part of the conga line. Now, Fred's lung, whatever you want it to be, Fred's eye, just his eye, is a part of Fred, presumably, right? But is Fred's eye a part of the conga line? I don't know. That's a kind of an interesting question. We're not concerned with reflexivity tonight, so we'll leave it at that. If you're interested in that, you can always DM me on Instagram at philosophywethink, and I can send you some papers over reflexivity and stuff like that. I'd be happy to. The next axiom that classical mereology is committed to is transitivity. And this one's pretty straightforward. I don't know of any real hearty denials of transitivity, but it's possibly out there. And transitivity just states, if A is a part of B and B is a part of C, then A is a part of C, right? So now that I'm looking at it, my first example was a denial of transitivity. Sorry about that. I got the two terms mixed up. It's not, so reflexivity. Yeah. Okay. Sorry about that. Scratch what I just said. Reflexivity. Let's move back a little bit. Everything is a part of itself, right? So, let's take Fred. It seems wrong to say that Fred is a sort of part of himself, right? But we'll leave those for now. Yeah, sorry. This it's not the focus of the episode. I don't want to get bogged down in something that's not the focus tonight. So take that example that I gave from Fred's conga line earlier, and apply that to transitivity. I had my notes mixed up. So the conga line, that's an example against transitivity. I was off there. But the next tenet that they're committed to, these classical mereologists, is unrestricted composition. And that's really where we're going to spend the beef of our episode tonight, which says, whenever there are some things, there is at least one thing that they compose. So this unrestrictedness on your ontology, and your ontology just being what you believe exists, this sort of unrestricted nature that you have. Go back to our car. We've got the car. When you put the water bottle on top of the car, that made a new thing. So you may be sitting there wondering, from the original example, how I said, with our little space, our rectangle space, we've got A, B, and they're touching, and then you've got C, and A and B, when they touch, exhibit some sort of new property. You may be going, yeah, okay, I can see how there's four. You explained how there's three, because the nihilist denies the existence of composites. But how is there seven? You said there's seven, but what are you talking about? Well, on this unrestricted composition picture, there is no difference in spatial relation or connection or sort of function. You put two things in a spatial realm, you can make a composite out of them. So A and B, that makes something, right? A makes something, B makes something, C makes something. But so does B and C, despite being spatially disconnected. So does A and C, despite being spatially disconnected. And so does A, B, and C. Now, you might find this interesting, and we may talk about it. I find it interesting from my thesis perspective. So the other half of my thesis is the study of a sort of Buddhist metaphysics. And for that, I'm reading a little bit of the Neo-Confucian philosopher Wang Yongming, which if those of you that are tuned into our show really closely, you might know that that's a hint for what's coming next week. Big episode next week. But Wong and the Neo-Confucians believe in this interconnectedness, this unity of the universe. So there's this thing, and this is a very impoverished education on that. So if I misstate anything, for those of you that know this Wang Yang Ming metaphysics and epistemology better, please correct me. But essentially, there's this thing called the pattern, which is an underlying universe, or an underlying connectedness, an underlying sort of spiritualness in the universe. And we all, if we meditate, or if we retire into ourselves, we can understand this pattern that we are all one, right? So we're all a part of oneness, in that sense. So as to not get too bogged down in the philosophical language, or to not get past my depth, I'm sort of reminded of this here, right? Because everything makes something in that sense. Everything is related. You don't have to be physically or spatially connected to be connected, right? So A can be connected to C in our original example without being touching. Now, the question is, we want to give an answer, right, to this unrestricted composition, because it seems odd. It seems very against common sense to say that A and C form an object. So how do we decide, right? How do we decide how many objects there are in this original rectangle of space that I gave you? It doesn't seem like we can get it empirically, right? It doesn't seem like we can just go out and look and say, okay, in our finest laboratory, the question of A and B, whether they compose something. Well, it seems kind of hard to say, you know? And Peter Van Inwagen's article on special... Oh, I can't remember the name. Sorry, I've read it. When do parts become objects or something like that? He explores these sort of like, is it fusion? Is it contact? Is it... Empirical means don't seem to get at the question strongly enough. And it also seems not purely theoretical. It doesn't seem like we can get an analytic answer, or an a priori answer, I guess I should say. Maybe we can get at an a priori answer, but it doesn't seem like we can get at an analytic answer that's just true by definition, right? And there's no conceptual contradiction of how to define part. Maybe there is, but that's not really the big deal here. So we're going to look for something that's a priori and synthetic to answer the question. And if you're wondering what that is, you'll just have to stick around till after the break, and I'll let you know. All right, guys. Thanks for listening. Thank you.
Hi, I'm King Charles. Welcome to KCR. What's it?
917.
Austin. Hi, I'm King Charles. Welcome to 917 Austin.
KVRX.
Support comes from Texas Athletics. For all full-time UT students, this is your single ticket access to all of our events. Yes, all of them. That's over 120 home regular season events a year. For more information, you can visit texassports.com/bigticket. Once again, that's texassports.com/bigticket.
We keep campus running, and you can support your favorite student media organizations right now. If you're wondering
how, why,
well, you can visit supportstudentvoices.org
to lend us a helping hand. By doing this, you can chip in or donate to your favorite TSM organizations
like KVRX 91.7, The Drag Audio,
Texas Student Television,
The Cactus Yearbook,
and even our campus newspapers, The Texas Travesty and Daily Texan.
Remember, it's supportstudentvoices.org. Stay tuned.
Remember, it's supportstudentvoices.org and stay tuned. Okay? hey, guys. This is DJ DeMorgans from Philosophy, We Think. And you're listening to KVRX 91.7. I'm a philosophy talk show. We are a philosophy talk show. We're missing our spirit that moves the world forward, DJ Geist, tonight
as well as our guest, our projector, our guest who was supposed to be here, but unfortunately fell ill. So we wish him to feel better. That being said, what we've been talking about tonight is the paper by Gideon Rosen and Sion Dorr, Composition as Fiction. I've been discussing my thesis on myriological nihilism, really, is the focus. Myriology and myriological nihilism. So before, we were talking about classical myriology. We were talking about this example of the rectangular box of space with point particles A, B, and C present. And A and B are spatially touching or connected, so much so that they experience or have a new function. And then we were asking the question, how many objects are in this space? Common sense says 4, right? A, B, and C, and A and B, the new thing made out of A and B. But then we looked at myriological nihilism that says, no, it's just A, B, and C. And we kind of motivated that a little bit before by Peter Unger's I Do Not Exist, a little review. And then finally, we talked about this crazy picture that says there's 7, the classical myriology. There's A and B and C, there's A plus B, there's A plus C, there's B plus C, and there's A plus B plus C. We were trying to find a way to respond to that. So, one common response in philosophy is the sort of common sense, right? Common sense motivates a lot of our, maybe not a lot, but some of our responses, some of our plausible responses in philosophy. So you may say something like, skepticism is well responded to with appeals to common sense. I always think of the popular, I believe it was Thomas More, I believe I'm stating that correctly, who allegedly was responding to skeptics who said, how can we even know the body exists? And he said, he held up his hands and he said, look, I got hands. The body exists. That's sort of this appeal to common sense. I think that's a great example of it. But this sort of intuitive pull, this sort of evident feeling that we get from looking at our hands and going, yeah, my hands exist. It's not necessarily so strong when we're talking about unrestricted composition. You may view it as something trivial, right? Keep in mind, the unrestricted composition believer or the classical myriologist doesn't have to believe that, in our example, A and C, A plus C, that object, they don't have to believe that it has a different function, that it does something different. It just exists, right? So here's a more concrete example. Suppose someone puts a 2-pound ball on and a feather on a table. And they ask you, how many objects weighing more than 1 pound are there in front of you? Your first thought is 1, right? The ball, that's 2 pounds. But this classical myriologist would suggest, no, you're ignoring countless amounts of objects. The top 2/3 of the cannonball weighs, what would that be? 1.5? I don't know. The bottom 2/3 also weighs 1.5. I don't know. The ball plus the feather. None of these things is sufficiently thingy, I guess, for lack of a better word, to feature as an object of concern or attention. So perhaps it's even properly ignored, but that doesn't mean that it doesn't exist. And when we sort of do this reflection and we say, yeah, that's maybe that's a good point, right? It doesn't seem like anything's contradictory here, or anything's outlandish in the sense that skepticism is outlandish. So maybe common sense can answer the question for us. Now, that's for universal. It's slipped my mind. Unrestricted composition. Sorry. But what about the common sense appeals to compositional nihilism? Right? You say, actually, cars don't exist. Now you might have that evident sort of feeling, that sort of invocation of strong emotions, that clarity that says, of course cars exist. You can't deny the composite object of a car. Or as Van Inwagen would say, you can't deny the composite existence of the self, the body. Maybe the self I should stick with. But the nihilist seems to have a response to this. Just say it's atoms arranged car-wise that serve the same functions. But these atoms need to sort of cohere in a certain way, right? They still serve that function. They serve that specific thing. It's just, I don't want to posit that a new formal thing exists. And when I mean formal, I'm referencing well, maybe I shouldn't go there. I'll leave that. But I don't want to posit that a new thing exists. I just want to say that atoms arranged car-wise is what we designate as a car. And if you listened to our last episode on the philosophy of Buddhism, you'll start to see the connections between the metaphysics of Buddhism and the sort of modern mereological debate that we're covering here. So maybe common sense isn't that great, right? What can we appeal to? Well, maybe we can appeal to science, right? The sort of evidence of something like astrophysics, which says, yeah, atoms are built up of protons and neutrons, and galaxies are built up of stars. And these stars compose to make galaxies. This is sort of different because it gives us a stronger connection in the sense that maybe you could take a principle that you might want to believe with science, something like it's rational or maybe even rationally obligatory to believe the best and most acceptable scientific theory, and in particular, to believe in the real existence of the objects that exist according to that theory. The difference here from common sense being a sort of data, a sort of empirical grasp, to some sense. But it seems like maybe there's some problems here too. And Gideon Rosen and Sion Dior, or sorry, Dior, Sion Dor, outline 5 possible problems with this sort of rationally obligatory. And I think that's an interesting epistemic question. Do you have a rational obligation to believe in science? Or do you have, is it strictly rationally permissible, but you may believe in other things? Well, I don't know. But those 5 things, those 5 problems that they raise, let's start with the first one. The best theory is often known to be false. I might need a drink of water soon. But Take something like general relativity. Now, I'm not going to claim to be some sort of scientist or physicist at all in this podcast. All of the knowledge that I have of that comes from this paper and maybe a little bit of HBO Max watching The Big Bang Theory. But as far as I'm aware, general relativity is not as well explained, or is not as explanatory as something like quantum physics. But often, when scientists are making calculations or they're using theories, right? They often take general relativity for granted. Even though it's incompatible with the more successful theory of quantum field. It's an interesting point. They distinguish between, this is Doran Rosen, they distinguish between a sort of strict and weaker limit of belief in this sense, and it starts to allude to their conclusion, which I'm running out of time. I have 9 minutes, so I'll start working my way there. But we'll get to that in a minute. So let's cover this second one. Sometimes the best theory we have simply isn't good enough. It's not explanatory enough. An instance of this is the origins of life. So as far as I'm aware, the RNA world hypothesis is the most promising theory that we have right now to explain the origins of life. And even still, it's completely not explanatory enough to be confident in. Just because we have some sort of speculative promise in it doesn't mean that its merits of strong credence and merits a rational belief, a very confident response from us to believe in it. Also, as the third, sometimes the best theory we have is not substantially better than its closest rival. Right? So, until the 1960s, the Big Bang theory versus the steady state theory, the steady state growth theory, both had pros and cons, and it seemed fair to be a scientist and put your belief in either one. It seemed rational to believe in either one. What if I'm presented with two rational cases? Two completely, maybe not completely, but two very close cases. Very plausible options, right? Like unrestricted composition or compositional nihilism. Keep in mind, we're trying to determine the question of how many objects, how many parts are in this space? Is it 3? Is it 7? Is it 4? Maybe the theories are all right next to each other. Maybe they're equally plausible. Or, at best, not distinct enough to make a decision, to make a very confident decision. Right, so sometimes, and finally, I believe this is the final one. Let's see. Maybe not. But sometimes the best theory employs, yeah, this is the last one, a sort of simplifying assumption that can be a real problem. So from what I understand out of the paper, space and time as a continuum is just assumed for a mathematical convenience in physics, in astrophysics particularly. You can't do astrophysics, you can't do the calculus without assuming that space and time are a continuum. But that's simply a convenience. We don't know that space and time are a continuum. So is this convenience a plausible grounding for rational belief? Well, probably not. And this goes, it touches up against our common sense point. Just because it kind of makes sense upon immediate reflection doesn't mean that it's necessarily true. Just because it's convenient that some of the evidence that we have shows that this could be the case, or some of the things that we posit shows that this could be the case, doesn't ground a rational belief in it. Now, the sort of canonical way of refuting these myriological commitments is to change all of the sort of like singulars to plurals. So take something, for the instance, replace every occurrence of "there is something which" with "there are some things," things, plural, right? Replacing every occurrence of "for everything" with "whenever there are some things," right? And now we have this breakdown of myriological commitments. So that being said, if science, and I'm going to skip a lot of the paper here because I only have 4 minutes left and I need to get out of here. But if we can't trust science, if we can't trust common sense, what do we do? How do we answer these questions? Well, as I was saying at the beginning of the episode, they give a rather unsatisfactory answer. The answer is sort of what they term as fictionalist agnosticism. So we're not going to exclude an answer. We're just going to say, as of now, where we are, it's not evident that some views I really need a drink of water, guys. But we haven't excluded an answer. It's just not evident what the answer is. Unrestricted composition, myriological nihilism, or the sort of standard common sense view. It may be evident that some views... are not compatible with certain other views. But you can't live practically or intellectually agnostic. So what we can do is assume statements, this fictionalist agnosticism. Say, when anybody asked me, do composites exist? How many objects exist in the realm of that space, that rectangle space? Remain agnostic. Say, I don't know. But in general, what we should say is, when we assert things like water has two hydrogen molecules and oxygen, we're assuming a composite, right? So you can say we should put on that. Attack on that in our mind, that they're saying, on the assumption of composite objects, water has two hydrogens and an oxygen. So this sort of fictionalist before, on the assumption that, and this agnosticism of saying, if you get asked, say, I don't know. That's how we should live our daily life. And that's the sort of practical implant of philosophy. I know, I'm not satisfied with it either. It's not a very charming conclusion, but that's where we're at. All right, guys, thank you very much for tuning in to Philosophy We Think, this lovely solo episode. I loved having you guys, and we will see you next week with the lovely Harvey Lederman.